going to mug me?
Am I going to mug you?
Is that gorgeous or what, eh?
And I believe I can run the Beaver Marathon.
Download Veely now.
In 1459, a book was written that contained images so bizarre that even 500 years later, their meaning is still shrouded in mystery. It depicts improbable medieval siege engines and machines of war, figures in extraordinary apparatus, and bloodthirsty duels. But key information is missing from the manuscript, and the author is displayed cryptically holding a broken chain. Why was this manuscript ever written? And who could have unlocked its full potential? This book will reveal the secrets of a medieval age far more advanced than future generations would ever imagine. Deep in the vaults of the Royal Library in Denmark is a book over 500 years old. Its time-worn leather cover bears one simple inscription: Talhofer, the mysterious fight master of the Middle Ages. This enigmatic book is written in Swabian, an ancient German dialect, and contains 300 color pages of images and text, offering an astounding account of life in the Middle Ages.
This is Talhofer's actual 1459 manuscript, beautifully executed with colours as fresh as if it were painted yesterday. And there's Talhofer himself in the centre, dictating to his scribe.
The coded imagery and text within this manuscript has the potential to dispel the very beliefs the modern world has about the medieval age. Was combat and warfare technology really as primitive as we imagined? Did knights act as chivalrously as depicted in Victorian times? And was the population as unsophisticated as history suggests?
This is an incredibly important document because it tells us so much about this mysterious world. It's really a kind of box of secrets that we can open.
For the first time, the Royal Library in Denmark have allowed the manuscript to be filmed, and a team of experts from around the world will investigate the mysterious images and text within by using cutting-edge computer graphics and attempting unorthodox fighting techniques.
It's actually making me sick to my stomach.
Decoding the book's puzzling designs and constructing its enigmatic machines.
Really get pumping, he's underwater now.
The team will test the methods and technologies in the manuscript and attempt to establish just how authentic Talhofer's depiction of the medieval age really was. Talhofer's fight book has lain dormant in Copenhagen's Royal Library for over 200 years. But 500 years after it was written, the manuscript has re-emerged in the public eye, with martial arts students worldwide seeking its medieval fighting techniques. One fight master who has dedicated his life to learning the fighting styles of the Middle Ages is John Clements. Clements is one of the world's leading experts in the field of medieval martial arts.
We know very little about Talhofer as a man, about his life, so he's a mystery in that regard. But we do know he's a master of the art of arms, that he's a knight, that he is a teacher, an instructor of knightly fighting arts.
Talhofer has dedicated nearly half the manuscript to medieval combat. And within these pages are numerous plates, focusing on the violent and mysterious world of judicial duels. They are clearly identifiable by the marked area the combatants were forced to fight in.
Many of the images in this manuscript are concerned with fighting in the judicial duel. Now, the judicial duel was a curious institution when somebody had accused somebody of something and there were no witnesses, there was no evidence. Then trial by combat was the way you found out who was telling the truth.
On the eighth plate of his fight book, Talhofer describes why a person will be called forth for judicial battle. Murder, treason, heresy, disloyalty, betrayal, falsehood. or using a maiden or lady. Those that broke these laws would often be forced to face each other in judicial combat. Illustrated in Talhofer's manuscript is a bloody portrayal of the medieval population locked in these lawful battles, violently dispatching their opponents with a deadly array of weaponry, including one traditionally designed for defense that had been modified to kill. Aaron Pineberg knows all too well the advantages of a shield against an enemy.
I'm a SWAT officer in Appleton, Wisconsin. I carry a ballistic shield in front of me as my primary duties. That shield and this shield share a lot of common traits in that it can interfere with your vision, with your ability to see your enemy. If you can't see your enemy, you can't kill him. So it's important that when you use a shield, you understand that there are times when you give up that protection or that defensive capability to see your opponent.
This huge spiked shield, or pavis, from Talhofer's manuscript, is believed to have its origins in the 12th century, where shields were regarded as an acceptable weapon in dueling for the common, non-noble classes. Its cruel spikes and scythe-like hooks are used to devastating effect in Talhofer's manuscript, and John and Aaron will test whether the shields could really be used as the Fightmasters claimed.
We're going to try these weapons out. We're going to see how they move, how they perform, how the plates from Talhofer hold up to physically reconstructing it and applying what we know of the fighting arts that he displays.
To ensure any chance of victory in a judicial shield battle, two techniques outlined in Talhofer's manuscript, hooking with the shield to expose the opponent and planting the base firmly in the ground to create a more effective barrier, would have to be utilized.
But I can see how that's what you'd be doing.
And look at how quickly they lock up.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought, I can lock and pull.
Planting that shield and then working around it, using it as a barrier between me and the enemy, is incredibly fast. You see the holes because the holes are created between the two junction of the shields.
Such was the shield's effectiveness as an offensive weapon that a sword was not even required to dispatch an enemy and leave the judicial ring victorious.
I can say, we clearly could see that the techniques from Talhofer's manuscript absolutely apply under, the over, the displacing, the warding, the hooking, the thrusting, all the footwork, all the motions, they're all there. This is a vicious, ugly type of fighting, and I have a lot more respect for it.
Although unusual to see combatants fighting merely with shields, it's not the strangest image in Talhofer's manuscript. Another set of plates involving judicial fighting redefines the battle of the sexes.
Contained within this section of the manuscript is a fight between a man and a woman. It's a type of duel, a dispute that has to be settled by combat to the death. It's the first appearance of man-woman dueling in a fight book.
This image of a woman battling a man is a far cry from the image of the medieval woman uninvolved in the violent world of men.
Medieval women were much more powerful than they've been given credit for. And especially through the 14th century, they gained more power and were able to run businesses and things like that. And it was only the Renaissance when things started to go wrong and women were seen as more passive and inactive.
The evidence in the manuscript suggests that in some cases, women were even able to fight a man in a judicial duel.
This is a really, really difficult image to decipher because certainly what you do have at this time are very strong women. I mean, women are left to run castles while their men are off fighting. It's laid out as if this is something that did happen. But you wonder what the kind of legal reason for that would have been.
A man and a woman might be forced to fight like this because of any number of disputes. It might involve property, it might involve inheritance, it might involve accusations. This is a ritual combat, it's a semi-religious affair, and they know that only one of them can emerge alive.
Even more disturbing than judicial battles often being fought to the death is that some interpretations of the text imply that the combatants may have even been husband and wife. A recreation of the duel could provide valuable insight into why the couple was forced to fight in such a bizarre manner.
It would be interesting to reconstruct one of these judicial combats as a living archaeological experiment to understand something about the physical components of the fighting actions and the techniques, and also something of the mental and emotional component of the combatants.
The hole and the weapon fulfilled multiple functions. Firstly, they balanced out the fighting inequality between the sexes. And secondly, just like the judicial shields, the weapons were deemed suitable for commoners.
They gave her a heavy rock inside of her veil to use it like it's a flail. It's not a manly weapon, it's not a war weapon, it's not a self-defense tool, but they're clearly saying, here, you can use this, it's going to be lethal. Bash his skull in.
Bettany Hughes will test the effectiveness of a rock in a veil against the skull of a sheep.
When you're up close with all this gear, you realise this was certainly not play fighting. I mean, this thing is heavy in my hands, and I imagine just one of these is going to be a killing blow. That is actually sickening, because if you can imagine, that would have been a real man's head. He would never have survived a blow like that. So if Tauhofer was depicting reality rather than just some theory, then this would have caused a huge amount of suffering in the medieval world.
This 1542 image of a judicial duel between two knights suggests that such violent justice was part of the medieval world. And in 1228, there is even a case in Switzerland of a woman defeating a man in the same violent manner as depicted in Tauhofer's manuscript. The garments worn by the combatants, which they were literally sewn into, ensured that they could not conceal anything that could be used in the fight. It was also possible they were made of leather and treated with oil, to be made slippery so non-fatal grappling moves would be ineffective, and only a decisive killing blow would end the ritualized combat.
First off, I'm sewn into this garment. I'm buried it basically halfway up in a hole. I'm not going anywhere. I'm literally figuratively stuck here. I feel absolutely demeaned. The reach advantage, I thought, would be to the woman or to the person outside the hole, but in actuality, I'm not having a problem. It's kind of like a strike for a strike, almost.
I'm learning that it's hard to strike the head at the same time as be aware of the club. You have to be very fast on your feet to do both, but with a little practice, I think it would be okay.
And practice was exactly what combatants could get.
This is a type of combat that these participants would have entered knowing when they're going to fight, how they're going to fight, and who they're going to fight weeks in advance. That has to affect their psyche, and it has to affect their training.
A closer examination of the manuscript reveals that Tauhofer wasn't just depicting a generic image of the duels. Each plate contains specific moves that with specialized training could be used to defeat their opponent.
I'm dumping her on her head, and I'm bringing this club down right after her. And I'm gonna probably crush her or stab her. There's nothing she can do from here.
It is possible that Tauhofer included these specific images in his fight book to train the combatants and earn an income. It is recorded that he had the responsibility of being judge in judicial duels, a perfect vantage point to learn the most effective death-dealing techniques. Combatants could learn these methods from Tauhofer, most likely for a fee, to ensure victory in the eyes of both the law and God.
The conclusions that we can reach tentatively about this kind of duel. It's let us understand it's brutal. It's set up to cause a decisive outcome. This is the world they lived in, a violent age, a violent world.
But Talhofer's vision saw beyond the restricting circle of the judicial duel. Not satisfied with merely recounting in bloody detail his field of expertise, he turned his attention to the machines born of war. This 16th plate of Talhofer's manuscript depicts a siege engine used extensively throughout the medieval period. This is a great trebuchet, wherewith one may throw stones and break cities and forts. Talhofer was a fight master, not an engineer. So why would he include siege engines in his manuscript? And where did he get the designs for these machines of war?
Talhofer is not the only secret war book we have in the medieval period in Europe. When you look at all the manuscripts, you can see different machines copied in all the manuscripts.
These images in Talhofer's fight book have been taken from Conrad Kaiser's 1405 Bellifortis, and Peter Wemming thinks he knows why Talhofer included them within his manuscript.
I see them more like a CV or something. This writer or engineer wants us to present his work to a king or whatever, to get a job, simply as that.
Siege engines could tip the power balance and would be vital for warring factions attacking castles and fortified towns that covered the medieval landscape. The machine from Talhofer's manuscript could provide the key to ensuring victory in this war-torn land. It was, in effect, a medieval arms catalogue.
Talhofer lived in what was called the Holy Roman Empire, which makes it sound like it's one consolidated block. But actually, these were warring tribes, warring kingdoms, where everybody was at each other's throats the whole time. Unlike the original Roman Empire, where you had one centralized military force, everybody had to fight for themselves.
And in these battle-scarred lands, men who claimed knowledge of the mightiest of siege engines would more likely be in demand from wealthy and powerful patrons.
This is a manuscript that's been very deeply researched. It must have been incredibly expensive to produce. And Talhofer, you imagine, must have expected some kind of financial kickback from all of his work.
Talhofer didn't stop with merely claiming knowledge of common siege engines. The Fightmaster's ambitions saw him present even bolder designs in his arms catalogue. And no machine was too radical for his visionary mind.
So many exciting machines in this book. And this one is one of the more ambitious of the designs.
The Swabian text above the image, when translated, reads, "One shall make two wagons of this form, as viewed from below. From there, within the wagons, folk combat those outside. They fight with the guns and the lances. The lorication is all around them." In two dimensions, the machine is difficult to comprehend. But once it is fully realized in three dimensions, its mystery is revealed. The design in Talhofer's manuscript is almost unbelievably depicting an armored tank. The reference to lorication in the text is a term describing plated armor. But how could such a heavy protected vehicle ever be moved?
It's a tank. It's possibly the first tank. We have to interpret things. You can see how this comes off the page here. Well, the text tells us that there are two carriages, that it's pushed by horses. So there are horses in here harnessed up, so it's going that way. This is a machine designed to go into the enemy. But what's it do when it gets there? Well, look, it's got 5 cannon on each side. This is 1459, but gunpowder has been around a while. These cannon are drawn with such detail, you can see the touch hole on each of them.
Driven by a team of horses and mounted with cannons, such a war machine seems improbable in medieval times. Did this tank really exist, and how vital was the heavy armor protecting it? A replica of a medieval cannon, similar to the design in Talhofer's manual, has been built by historical experts in Denmark.
By 1459, cast iron had been invented in the West, but it was only really used for cannonballs, and they couldn't yet bore and drill through a solid block. So they made it in the same way they made buckets and barrels. They made it with staves, single slats of iron that are held together by hoops, just like they are on a barrel. And that is why it's called the barrel of a gun.
By 1459, cannon technology was available that would allow multiple firing of the weapons from within the safety of the tank, a technology that is the distant ancestor seen on today's modern battlefield.
By around 1450, they had developed the breech-loading cannon. That meant you could put the cannon ball or the hail shot in at the breech end. And the secret to that technology was this, the breech pot. In here, you pre-prepared, you poured your gunpowder in there, and that was sealed with a wooden tampion.
The breech-loading technology could allow a gun crew to fire two or three rounds a minute. But how much damage could these medieval cannons really deliver?
Look at this. Look at this. It's just smashed through these boards. It's made a great big hole. Here we go. Look, there. It's gone right through that in a musket shape. Oh, this could have been a paper screen. So one thing that tells me is our tank would have to be an armoured vehicle. If you're going to take that vehicle into the enemy, which the horses behind and the wedge in front look like you are, then you must be armoured, because the enemy have got cannon just like that.
It's hard to imagine such a sophisticated machine in the medieval age, an age perceived as containing only primitive technology. But other historical sources besides Talhofer depict medieval tanks, suggesting that they were more than just the fight master's imaginative fancy. But not all objects in Talhofer's manual have such evidence to support them. Alongside the tank is an object even more difficult to comprehend.
We always get very excited about inventions of Greece and Egypt and Rome, but actually, this book is packed with incredibly ingenious inventions. One of my favourites is a very weird thing that looks like something out of a sci-fi movie, and we think it's called the crayfish.
This rig is called a crayfish. It conducts itself upon four speeding wheels. It shears front and behind. If one kindles munitions, then it shoots stones before it. Steel buckshot is a hail, wherewith one smites low the foes. Historical reproduction expert Richard Windley will attempt to decode the image of the crayfish and bring it to life.
Talhofer's crayfish is one of the most puzzling and enigmatic designs in his book. He tells us that it was made of iron, so that's helpful, and that it runs on four speeding wheels, and there's some kind of munitions inside it. And frustratingly, he says you make this rig as big or as small as you want, which really doesn't shed too much light on it. So really it's trying to work out what it could have been and, more importantly, how it could have been deployed. So bearing in mind all the various clues that we've got from the drawing, I've produced a design which incorporates as many of these elements as possible.
From the designs in Talhofer's manuscript, Richard will build the model to get a true sense of the object's capabilities. Here, for possibly the first time in 500 years, Talhofer's crayfish is revealed.
got all the main features that we get in the Talhofer illustration. We've got the big spikes at the front. We've got the cutting scimitar blades here, and also the extensions on the wheel, which will cut and maim if anyone gets in the way.
Richard has proved that the crayfish is a realistic design, but its construction doesn't answer the question as to why or where it might have been used. In a medieval castle or fortified town, one of the most vulnerable points was the gates, and these would need to be protected from attacks at any cost. Mike Lodes believes the crayfish could have been the perfect defensive system.
How about if this, the crayfish, was in a castle gateway or a gateway to a fortified town? Then you could see the ropes that made it go to and fro were embedded in channels in the flagstone floor. That would be very effective because you could have a man inside the wall working a windlass to make it go to and fro. If there were four, five, six of these going like this, who would ride a horse through that? Who would dare to run through that? It would take you off at the ankles. And what is more, the text tells us it has explosive devices in it that would send out a hail of shot.
Richard has incorporated this devastating explosive weaponry in his design of the crayfish.
There is a removable panel on here, which means we can get at the fusing for the grenades. Now, these are made to simulate cast iron, and it probably would have been full with metal fragments, something that's going to cause debris to fly in all sorts of directions. You really want to do some damage with this and take out as many enemy personnel as we possibly can.
Talhofer saw enough in the design to include the crayfish in his manuscript. By combining all the team's research, we can now visualize in computer graphics what such a device may have looked like in action, defending a stronghold. In theory, the crayfish was capable of repelling an enemy at the very threshold of a fortification, but for an attacking force to get that close in the first place was never an easy task. Talhofer again appears to have the right tool for the job, but the question remains, did it work?
There are a number of ways you can take a castle or fortification. You can dig tunnels underneath it, undermine it. You can do an escalade, which is taking ladders and siege towers up to the walls and piling over the top. Or you can simply try and blow the gates off. But how do you get your bomb to the gates? Well, one idea is to use Jamie here in his armor and say, well, you're wearing armor, just walk up to it. But up there are going to be archers.
The power of a war bow at short distance against a knight's armor could penetrate it at certain points. And if an archer was skilled enough, he could find the joint in the plate mail and kill the man inside. Risking knights like this would have been far too a costly method to storm a city's gates. But Talhofer's manual seems to offer a solution. Terry Jones, one of the famed members of the Monty Python team, is renowned for more than just comedy. He's an expert in medieval history. But some of Talhofer's depictions of siege warfare appear strange, even to him.
Talhofer's manuscript shows a lot of surprising images. I mean, there's one here, these people walking up to the castle under these sort of metal bells. I mean, how did they get them off in the first place? Very Python-esque to me. And here's this castle that's being protected by two huge cushions outside the front door. Very odd.
The description above this cryptic image gives little information away. See, they are going towards the fortress. With the basket, they should lurch around. Within the shelter of the basket, they go.
We know that so much in Talhofer works because things like trebuchets have been built and tested. So we know that he's talking about workable things. But when we come across something like this that's so bizarre, so weird, you think, well, would it work? And of course, the only way to find out is try and replicate it using the clues that are there. So let's build it. Let's shoot things against it and test it.
And this is what the team thinks the medieval siege device may have looked like.
We've had to guess at the material. Some people say it would have been cast like a bell. Others say it would have been clad in plate armor. I think that would have been far too heavy.
One material used in medieval times could have provided the strength of iron without its excessive weight.
Hardened leather is tough. It's what armor was made of during the Middle Ages. A lot of poorer knights were clad in cuir bouilli, boiled leather, hardened, tough leather.
So much importance is placed on what this device is made of because of what scholars believe the structure was used for. Getting men to the very walls of a castle under siege and surviving. As the siege bell drew near to its target, it would have to repel attack from very close range if the men inside were to survive.
So I'm going to give this the ultimate test. We're at extreme close range, less than 10 yards, and Ben here is shooting a very, very powerful bow of 80 pounds draw weight with a heavy war arrow. Do your worst, Ben. I expected that to punch right through. And it hasn't. It's penetrated, but it hasn't really penetrated that much. Certainly, one of the guys inside is bleeding, but he's not dead. That is remarkable stopping power. I think if we were to double this thickness, we really would have something of genuine defensive capability.
A second layer of leather would reduce arrow penetration significantly and still allow the siege bell to be carried by two men. It is feasible that such a device could make it to the walls of a castle with its occupants alive. Perhaps for those looking through Talhofer's arms catalogue and desiring the siege bell, it is possible they could acquire the information about its construction from the Fightmaster at a price. The satisfied warlord could then deploy it in any way he saw fit, placing a bomb, delivering a letter of ultimatum, or retrieving a fallen comrade in the field of battle. But a castle under siege would have more than just arrows at its disposal.
When I look at that, it's designed for one thing, and that is to withstand an aerial shot. If you're coming up to my walls and I've got broken masonry, then I am going to hurl them on top of you. That has got a good structural shape, and even very big boulders, I think, with that central strut in the middle, the guys inside, their heads are going to be okay.
With the correct military knowledge, these drawings in Talhofer's manuscript have been transformed into a two-man siege bell. But it was the armor on a medieval knight that took this protection a step further, by allowing the individual inside a far greater freedom of movement. The knights featured in Talhofer's 1459 fight book are primarily involved in violent and bloody activities. Talhofer was trained as a knight and would know their ways intimately. The knights of the Middle Ages are far removed from the honorable warriors that we perceive them to be today. They were more akin to brigands, some even robbing and killing rich merchants that crossed their lands, or battling each other in violent and deadly duels.
We think of the Middle Ages as the knights in shining armor fighting under the laws of chivalry. But of course, the truth was actually different. Chivalry was an idea, but the whole concept of knighthood, it was a cult of violence. It was violent young men killing each other, or preferably killing innocent citizens.
Honorable knights rescuing damsels in distress isn't the only dubious portrayal of these medieval warriors.
It was Laurence Olivier who was responsible for the misconception that armor was terribly heavy. In his film Henry V, he showed knights being lifted onto the horses by cranes. But in fact, of course, you couldn't fight if that was the case.
Many of Talhofer's plates dedicated to knights, it suggests he was targeting serious fighters to sell his services to, but more specifically, those with money. For a knight's armor was expensive.
The term for an armor in the Middle Ages was a harness, and you can see it's like a harness. It's all different bits that go on, and every single bit has to be tailor-made for the body. Anything that's not quite right will pinch and rub. This is probably about 60 pounds of metal on him, but it's evenly distributed, and it gets a lot of its strength from its shape. These are glancing surfaces. A sword will glance off them, so these curves give quite thin plates remarkable tensile strength.
For it to be truly effective, a knight's armor had to allow the freedom of movement to match the swiftness of a lesser armored opponent on the battlefield. And also let a knight climb or mount a steed quickly. But the design couldn't compromise on its protective capabilities. And it had to be able to withstand what is perhaps the pinnacle of medieval metallurgy, the long sword. In many of his depictions of fighting techniques, Talhofer reveals the weapon's deadly efficiency. The craftsmanship that went into these blades meant that they had the potential of being the most formidable weapons during the Middle Ages.
What I've got here is a Talhofer longsword. It's based on one of the illustrations in his 1459 manual. This sword has a balance point about 2 inches in front of the guard, which means that the blade can rotate easily about that point. The heat treatment on a medieval longsword blade would have been incredibly sophisticated. They were making a blade that would both hold an edge and would also flex during use is quite amazing. Very, very sophisticated workmanship. The heat treating on a sword is a two-part process, which is the quenching, which makes the blade hard, but ever so slightly brittle. And then there's tempering, which is a lower temperature process of about 200 centigrade, which makes the blade flexible again. It's combining an awful lot of things. It's got devastating cutting power and fine balance.
But despite a medieval sword blade's technology, they still weren't able to cleave through the hardened plate steel of a knight's armor.
With a sharp, historically accurate, robust blade designed for fighting armor, you're simply not going to get through to wound him with an edge blow. It doesn't matter how hard I hit him or where I hit him, I can't cut through the armor with edge blows.
But a single plate in the fight book reveals a long sword technique against a knight, almost forgotten by the modern world. An unarmored man might be forced to fight an armored opponent due to rules stated in a judicial duel, or in the field of battle, or beyond the city walls trying to escape from the robber knights.
Talhofer gives us the way of fighting a knight and beating him, and that is through the techniques of half-swording, where we're going to try and get that point in his visor, underneath his helmet, into his groin, behind his knee, under his arm, where he would normally have chainmail armor protecting him. But even then, the point's going to penetrate.
This technique of half-swording used on unarmored opponents and relied on the fact that some medieval blades were not sharp their entire length and could be gripped when using specific fighting techniques. And one such move would make an opponent's armor almost irrelevant.
The interesting features about this sword are that not just the blade is able to be used offensively, the guard and the pommel are both pointed, and if you wanted to, you could use those as an active part of the weapon.
Talhofer shows that besides the point, you also can use the hilt effectively to knock him about the head, to bash him with the pommel, or the pummel may even be where the phrase to pummel someone to death comes from. Striking with a hilt like this is like smashing with a warhammer. It doesn't look very lethal, but the mass and the weight on it actually has a tremendous amount of force behind it, and it will knock him senseless.
John Clements is going to try these half-sword techniques against a knight in full armor to test their effectiveness.
So dangerous and potentially deadly in this thing that there's really not much I can do to try and hold back at all. I mean, I'm committed. And once I'm committed, the suit has a weight and deadliness all to its own.
Fighting unarmored against an armored knight, such as Talhofer shows in his plate, I felt obviously more agile and quicker, but it didn't make that much of a difference. He wasn't so slow that I can take advantage of it. I saw openings, but I can't get to them because he's all over the place. But what I was able to do is hit with that hilt. We know these techniques, we train in these techniques to go all out and fully do it, and to see that pommel smash and put a dent in his armor, and to see him pause because of that blow, that was enlightening. Wait, turn the snake up.
You good?
He's good.
What happened there, Aaron?
Well, in honesty, I'm still feeling the effects of that pommel strike from earlier when he hit me with the rear of his sword. The pommel on the end of it had so much momentum carrying right through the armor. It's actually making me sick to my stomach, and I'm having a hard time catching my breath and staying in the fight because I'm just sick. I felt it through my whole body.
This is the helmet he was wearing here. It's a historically accurate reproduction. It's the right thickness of metal, the right kind of metal, and the dents that were put on it. It's not easy to dent this kind of helmet, this kind of metal, and when I threw the blow, I could see him react. I was frankly pretty darn surprised that I could get it in there with that kind of force. We train hard, we train in these moves from Talhofer, and Talhofer specifically shows this technique in his image of an unarmored fighter against an armored fighter. It really does validate that technique.
Despite its brutal imagery and title, Talhofer's fight book was not entirely focused with the martial arts and warfare. Contained within its pages is material from many facets of life in the Middle Ages, including this bizarre image. Its purpose, like many in the book, is shrouded in mystery.
These illustrations are extraordinary. Here we've got frogmen, people in diving suits. This is 1459.
The head is covered with a hard helm, be it that the water runs strongly then you should burden yourself with weights so that you may submerge and emerge again too.
Talhofer tells us so much in this manuscript. There is so much information, but there's also little key bits of information missing. And this is a classic example. We've got a diving suit, but he doesn't actually explain where the oxygen comes from. Perhaps he needs us to go to him, to pay him, to tell us what that missing bit of information is.
But could a diving suit actually exist over 500 years ago? At the medieval center in Denmark, historians have built a diving suit from images taken from another 15th century source. But does this technology really work?
This helmet is slightly different to the one that we see in the Talhofer manuscript. What we see depicted there is what's actually known as a frogmouth helmet, very appropriately for a frogman. It's a frogmouth helmet, which is used for jousting. The point is, you need a solid helmet to put the air in. Basically, what's going to happen is this is going to act like an air bell, a very simple primary technology, the first of its kind. And I'm very glad that he's doing it and not me.
Although the secret to supplying air to a man underwater is not revealed, the likely technology required is contained within the manuscript. A set of bellows attached to an air bladder. Historical engineers found that getting this technology to work wasn't as easy as they initially perceived.
When you have a big amount of air in a big bellow that you need to compress to get it down to the diver, you don't have enough force to press it into the hose and down to the diver. So we had to go back and make three small bellows with very long levers on, so you have a lot of power to pump the air. It's a lot of hard work to work the bellows. They need to be pumped really hard and fast to get enough air down to the diver. But I think we are about ready. Are you ready, guys?
Ready. Ready.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. We've got to buckle that front and back because as the air goes in, then this would float off once it's in water. But already, the guys are pumping away. Here he goes down. We've got to keep this pipe straight. And there he is, he's in the water. Really get pumping, he's underwater now. You can see the bubbles, it's working. This is fantastic, you can see this technology. Technology that was thought about probably before 1400, and it's working. That man is underwater and he's breathing. And he's breathing through this pipe, and there's guys pumping on those bellows. It's quite extraordinary.
The test you see here is limited to 10 minutes, but in medieval times, a diver could stay underwater for as long as there was a supply of men to pump the bellows.
This is the technology that put men on the moon. The idea that mechanical contraptions can override our biological limitations. Good job, Kurt.
The hammer.
Yeah. How was that?
Fine.
You're not wet there. The water only, it's only wet to here.
No problem at all.
Your whole face is dry. It's extraordinary. His whole face is dry.
The diving suit is one of the medieval world's great achievements, and the version depicted in Talhofer's manuscript appears to be more advanced than the suit the team in Denmark has just tested. It is closer in design to the closed air systems we have today and is more maneuverable and better fitted, with the air likely designed to escape from the sleeves and not around the face. Talhofer does not reveal why the diving suit was used, and possibly this, and all the other information the Fight Master excludes from his manuscript is the answer to the image of him holding a broken chain. Could it be that Talhofer was the missing link that made his 1459 fight book complete? For this manuscript offers us a glimpse into the violent and complicated world that we're only just beginning to truly understand.